Hello, it's John Dennis on Tuesday the 15th of September. Today, Peter Mandelson signals the start of a Labour fight back, with public spending set to dominate British politics between now and the election.
While the free fall in the economy may have been brought to an end, the effects of the recession are not yet behind us.
And Stalin's grandson goes to court to defend the reputation of one of the 20th century's most brutal dictators.
All this time since Stalin died, I mean, he's been dead for more than half a century. He's an extremely divisive figure.
But first, the headlines with Bill Overton.
Gordon Brown accepts there will have to be public spending cuts to pay for the money borrowed to help the banks during the recession. The Prime Minister will tell the trade unions, meeting at their conference in Liverpool, that the government needs to halve the borrowing deficit within 4 years. He doesn't think this can be achieved just by an improvement in the economy and increasing efficiency. In the US, President Obama's told Wall Street, the financial centre in New York, that bankers must accept a new sense of responsibility. He says they must scrap bloated bonuses and not go back to reckless behaviour. He's warned the country won't be prepared to bail out the finance industry a second time, and many of the firms now returning to prosperity owe a debt to the American people. The American military has announced they've killed a top al-Qaeda leader in Somalia. Special forces in helicopters flew into the African country to carry out the attack near the capital, Mogadishu. They claim they killed a man involved in bombings of the US embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. The Hollywood actor Patrick Swayze has died after a two-year battle with cancer. The star of the films Dirty Dancing and Ghost was 57. He'd carried on working on a TV series while he was seriously ill. Tennis, and in a shock win, one Martin Del Potro defeated the world number one Roger Federer in the final of the US Open. It's the 20-year-old Argentinian's first Grand Slam success and stopped the Swiss's chance of a record sixth win at the Open. Del Potro kept his nerve even after being 2-1 down. He'd already beaten the other main contender, Rafael Nadal, in the semi-final. The papers now, and the only story making more than one front page, involves Claire Irby, described as a posh society beauty, a descendant of the Guinness brewing family. Mile High Jinx is the Mirror's headline, while the Telegraph calls it just a misdemeanour. She appeared in court yesterday accused of being drunk on a plane where she stripped to her knickers and cavorted with a male passenger. Otherwise, there are several versions of new government plans. The Mail claims there will be a slop bucket in every home as the government bans the dumping of food waste in landfill sites. Bin men would then have to take the food waste to recycling sites. Our paper reports the government will admit it can't fulfil one of its promises to extend maternity pay from 9 months to a year. There just isn't enough money to pay for it. The Independent says the Children's Minister Ed Balls will pull the plug on child database. The paper believes moves to vet every adult who works with children will be watered down after warnings the scheme can't work. But not much of this may help the government if a Times poll is to prove true at the next election. A populist poll suggests that 48% of voters think anyone could do a better job of leading the Labour Party and the country than Gordon Brown. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The choice for voters at the next election is between progressive reform offered by Labour and ideologically driven retrenchment and deep cuts offered by the Tories. That's what Peter Mandelson said yesterday in a speech at the London School of Economics. It signalled a significant shift from Gordon Brown's insistence that the choice was between Labour investment and Tory cuts. In The Guardian's Westminster office, our senior political correspondent, Andrew Sparrow.
It was a long and considered speech about public spending, and it addressed the problem that the government has faced for the last few months, which is that, frankly, no one in the commentariat, in the kind of economics community or in the public at large, according to the polls, believes that the next election is going to be a choice between Labour investment and Tory cuts. The public think whoever wins the election, they're going to have to cut public spending. And what Peter Mandelson was doing yesterday was trying to finesse that argument, and he accepted that there would be tough decisions, as he put it, that would have to be made, that Labour wasn't committed to everlasting increases in public spending, but that there was nevertheless there was a fundamental difference between the Conservative approach and Labour approach. He said basically Labour the Conservative Party hate the state. They want to complete the Thatcherite agenda of dismantling the state. Labour believe in wise spending, not big spending. They'll protect services and build on the big increases in public spending that we've seen in the last 12 years to try and preserve the social democratic consensus.
The Tories and their friends are yearning for people to think that because there is a need for public spending constraint in the future, we face an era of deep, savage, indiscriminate, across-the-board spending cuts, whoever is in power.
What do you read into the fact that it was Peter Mandelson that made this speech and not Gordon Brown, given that Mandelson heralded the speech as the start of a Labour fight back?
Well, various things. One is that Peter Mandelson appears to be the person in the cabinet who's kind of thinking hardest about a strategy, taking on the tour. And he's a very political, always has been and still is, very political minister. And he enjoys the administrative side of his job. But he's seems to be doing more than anyone else in cabinet to try and find a line, a spin, if you want to call it that, using the old-fashioned word, but a way of attacking the Conservatives, a way of presenting the government's case. So it was a very sort of political speech, and in one sense he's the guy who frankly seems to do that better than any of the others. Secondly, I don't suppose it's a speech that Gordon Brown would have been comfortable with. I mean, he's embarrassed by the comments that he used to make about Labour investment versus Tory cuts. Peter Mandelson got embarrassed on the radio yesterday, where he challenged Nick Robinson to produce a quote where Brown had actually said that, and it didn't take Nick Robinson long to find the quote. Also, there was a speech that was full of New Labour terminology, and Gordon Brown's never been a sort of great one for New Labour either, so Brown would have found it embarrassing to live himself and wouldn't have been comfortable with the way it was presented. But it arguably should have been a speech that the Chancellor should have made. With Alistair Darling made his own speech on public spending last week, which is quite thoughtful, but certainly not as coherent and closely argued and well structured as the Mandelson one. So, coming back to your question, what it shows us, I think, is that sort of Mandelson is the key strategist in the government at the moment.
Andrew Sparrow, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, Ed Pilkington interviews the Unabomber's brother, the man who informed on him. That's at guardian.co.uk/America. We've got extracts from the new River Cafe cookbook with an introduction by Ronan Bennett. That's at guardian.co.uk/food. And Sarah Bosley, our health editor, on athletes who succeed after having children. guardian.co.uk/health. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in this edition of Guardian Daily, we'll hear from Japan, where thousands of dolphins are being slaughtered as the whaling season begins.
Within a few minutes of the beginning of the slaughter, the sea, which is usually a beautiful emerald green colour, begins to turn a very deep shade of red.
But first, the grandson of Russia's most feared dictator is suing a newspaper for saying that Joseph Stalin was responsible for killing Soviet citizens. Yevgeny Zhugashvili is seeking £185,000 from the Novaya Gazeta newspaper and £10,000 from the author of the article. Luke Harding reports from Moscow.
Novaya Gazeta, which is the main liberal opposition newspaper here, very regularly runs a whole series of articles on Stalin, on gulags, on political prisons, and is endlessly kind of rooting around the archives here. Now, they published, to my mind, what was an entirely kind of mainstream article about Stalin, saying that he was personally responsible for the executions of Russian civilians, ordinary Russians, and also talking about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which was the notorious agreement in August 1939 between Hitler and Stalin, where the two dictators decided to divvy up Eastern Europe. Anyway, this has all proved too much for a kind of amateur historian called Leonid Jura. And what he's done is he's launched a legal case against Novaya Gazeta. But far more than that, he has managed to track down Stalin's 73-year-old grandson, who's called Yevgeny Djugashvili, and who actually lives in Tbilisi in Georgia, and he's persuaded him to jump on an aeroplane, come to Moscow, and take part in this court case, which is rapidly turning into something of a sensation.
Millions died under Stalin's rule. Isn't that a matter of record?
Well, you'd have thought so. You'd have thought so. I was sitting in Jura's study, surrounded by a whole load of shelves of books on Stalin and his rather excited pet chihuahua. And I was sort of saying, look, you know, the Great Terror, 1937 to 1938, thousands of people, many of them ordinary Russians, a lot of them Bolsheviks shot dead, the gulags. Are you really saying that Stalin did none of this? And basically what Jura says is that most of this dirty stuff was done by Stalin's accomplices without his knowledge. And he says, as far as the gulags go, most of the people in them were criminals and deserved their fate. And essentially that he was a kind of good, magnanimous and benevolent leader, and that the Soviet system was far superior to not only the system in Russia today, but also to capitalism in general.
What's the view of the current leadership in the Kremlin?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The current leadership in the Kremlin, we're talking about Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev, really have been engaged in a campaign to, I would say, to rehabilitate Stalin. Now, critics here say there's a very good reason for that. They say that by sort of rehabilitating Stalin, if you like, they're in some way defending their own kind of rather authoritarian regimes, and the kind of domestic repression, which really is a kind of feature of everyday life here in Russia, especially if you're someone who sticks your head up against the Kremlin, against the government. But what we really have seen is the rewriting of history textbooks, which now stress Stalin's role, not as a mass murderer in the 20th century, but as an efficient manager who defeated the Nazis and industrialized a backward Soviet Union.
Luke Harding.
Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
What's that coming over the hill? It's Football Weekly Live, a special stream show beaming from near Earth orbit into your computer at 6 o'clock this coming Sunday. That day, of course, is the Manchester Derby and the Chelsea Spurs ding-dong affair. And as such, Football Weekly will be on hand to recycle other people's opinions as our own, even faster than usual, on all the day's big talking points. We'll have, as ever, a panel of top Guardian writers on hand. We'll have views from the grounds. And we'll have Sid Lowe phoning it in from Spain. You can chip in too, using the message boards or various other methods of communication, email, Twitter, or that SMS messaging business. That's Football Weekly, this coming Sunday at 6 o'clock, live. What could possibly go wrong?
In Japan, the whaling season is underway, and there's even more international outrage than usual this year, thanks to an award-winning American documentary called The Cove, which highlights the practice of culling dolphins. The Guardian's Justin McCurry has seen it for himself in Taiji, a town regarded as the spiritual home of Japan's whaling industry.
The Guardian's trip to Taiji coincided with the first hunt and cull of the current season, which began at the beginning of this month and will run through to sort of January, February next year. What they do is they round up dolphins out in the open seas. They bang sticks together under the water in order to disrupt the dolphins' very sensitive sonar systems. They then drag them back with nets into a larger cove and leave them there overnight, supposedly to calm down. But I stood on a beach and watched those dolphins after they'd been brought back to the main cove. They certainly didn't look very relaxed to me. Then early the next morning, just after sunrise, they are taken to a couple of inlets either side of the main cove, places that are very difficult to get to, very difficult to see unless you clamber through the undergrowth and perch on the top of the cliffs above. They drag them backwards through the water and then beneath a tarpaulin covers that they've erected so as to deter photographers and other people, activists in particular. And they then use knives and spears to kill the dolphins in the water. That's why, you know, within a few minutes of the beginning of the slaughter, the sea, which is usually a beautiful emerald green colour, begins to turn a very deep shade of red.
Why does the town of Taiji cull thousands of dolphins?
Well, there are two reasons that they usually give. One is that this is part of a tradition going back, right back to the early 1600s. There's a whale museum in Taiji, and there's evidence there that the local fishermen were hunting both whales and dolphins, you know, as long, way back as 400 years ago. So they say this is an important part of the town's cultural fabric, and that they should be allowed to continue that. They also say there are financial reasons. An average-sized bottlenose dolphin can fetch up to about $500 a piece. But other dolphins that could possibly be trained and used at dolphin shows, at aquariums, marine parks, places like that, can fetch as much as $150,000. So there's obviously some financial incentives for them to hunt dolphins. The other reason, and you know, conservationists say this isn't particularly convincing, but one of the reasons they say they have to continue the culls is that there are simply far too many dolphins. Taiji is located on the southern coast of Wakayama Prefecture, which is on the Pacific coast. It's a 4-6 hour train journey south of Tokyo. It's a long way south. They say the waters off the coast of Taiji have a large population of dolphins, and unless they keep those populations under control, the dolphins or pilot whales, which are the largest member of the dolphin family, will eat all the fish and of course ruin their livelihoods in that way. What the critics see as you know, the needless slaughter of these cute and intelligent mammals, the local fishermen see as an exercise in pest control more than anything else.
Justin McCurry.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Greyhound buses, associated with romantic road trips, epic journeys across the vast expanses of America, have come to the UK. The Guardian's Stephen Morris joined Greyhound's maiden voyage in Britain to get his kicks on the M3.
I've always dreamed of a trip on a Greyhound bus, travelling across the empty, beautiful landscapes of America, like a character out of a Simon and Garfunkel song or somebody from a Jack Kerouac book. But I've never quite made it. Happily, I'm going to get the chance to ride on a Greyhound today. I'm not to Chicago, though, or LA, or some godforsaken place in the centre of America. I'm in Southampton, just by the university. This is the maiden voyage of the UK version of Greyhound. They've brought the brand to Great Britain, and this is the first voyage, Southampton to London. So we're going to have a trip and see if it retains the romance, the magic that I always dreamed of. Very smart looking coach. It's got the Greyhound has landed on the front of it. And I think a band is going to strike up to celebrate. When the bus turned up, one of the members of the band said, "Well, it's just a bus. What's all the fuss about?" And he's right, in a way, it is just a bus, but it's a very nice bus. Lots of legroom, comfy seats, plug points, Wi-Fi access. Bit of a party atmosphere on board today as well. There's a guy playing guitar at the back. There's people going on their holidays. Complimentary champagne. We're going up the M3 at a good clip, and it's fine. Everybody's having a good time.
I feel like a star. That is brilliant.
And where are you going to?
We're going to London, and then we're getting the Eurostar to Paris because we're off on holiday for a few days.
So what do you think of this new bus coach?
I'm incredibly impressed. It's so luxurious. I mean, the leg room is... I mean, I'm used to having to scrunch my legs up, so to be able to stretch them out is... It's really impressive. In good condition as well. I mean, it's brand new, but it's like leather seats and stuff. It's brilliant.
Alex Warner, Managing Director, Greyhound UK. Customers are looking for a convenience service rather than necessarily scenery, and we're giving them a luxurious setting. We've got complimentary Wi-Fi, plug sockets, free newspapers, and legroom like never seen before. And I think if they're enjoying that luxury and travelling from A to B, they probably wouldn't mind whether there's an oil refiner or gasworks out the window.
So here we are, Victoria, central London. We're 10 minutes late, but that's not too bad. It was a Monday morning rush hour, so getting through the traffic was a bit tricky. Very pleasant, comfortable trip. But I have just been reading the blurb from Greyhound, and next time I might not go Southampton, London. I might go for this one, Million Dollar Highway, Albuquerque to Grand Junction, 382 miles. That might be my next trip with Greyhound, with any luck.
Stephen Morris reporting. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Andy Duckworth, Glenn Austin Anderson, and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.